Now you might like tomatoes, and that's okay with me. But please don't put one on my plate or splat one on my knee. Spaghetti sauce, tomato soup, I love with all my heart. But I don't like tomatoes, they always make me fart. Too unhappy.
Yes, well, where did the flavour go, and how do we get it back? Harry Klee is a professor at the University of Florida.
Now let's negotiate one thing for a start. Tomato or tomato?
Ah, well, in the United States, it's tomato.
I've never understood why.
I don't either. Well, it's potato and potato, right?
Yeah. Now, when I was small, tomatoes, and I suppose potatoes, tasted fantastic. Yeah. Now we go to incredible lengths to find ones that actually have flavor. I want to know, when did the flavor go from tomatoes and why?
Well, I think it probably traces back to the period of intensive breeding around World War II, when people really focused on producing massive quantities of fruit. So since World War II, the yields of tomato have gone up 300%. And that's phenomenal for a crop. And it directly coincides with the loss of flavor.
And I suppose what they did was breed a particular sort of tomato that would be available, not only in bulk, in huge numbers, but the year round.
Yes, I think that's a large part of the key to the problem, is that most people want a tomato year round. They want to be able to go in the wintertime and get that tomato. And so it has to be made somewhere, usually very far away, and it has to be shipped great distances, typically a week or longer to get there. So they've focused on things that are not necessarily anything to do with flavor, and they've basically neglected flavor.
You mean they could have bred something that kept in the hardiness but had flavor as well?
Flavor is extremely complex. The interactions of so many different chemicals that it's easy to lose it if you're not very actively trying to keep it. And I've talked to breeders who have told me that they breed for yield, they breed for size, they breed for color, they breed for disease resistance, and the very last thing they do is cut it open and taste it.
Yeah, see. How many people would be like me and say that they want to pay extra for a good tasting tomato?
Yeah, it's pretty much directly proportional. The higher the price, the fewer the people will buy it. And that's why you see in the farmers' markets, people in the United States will pay $5 a pound for these tomatoes in season, but the supermarket tomato is $1 a pound. And that just shows you the range right there. Very few people will pay $5 a pound. Almost everybody will pay $1 a pound.
What if I told you that from Australia, our tomatoes taste better? What would you say?
Yeah, well, the Europeans say that too, and they're wrong.
Before you said it was crap.
Well, the reality is that the seed market these days is global. And so in all likelihood, the companies that are producing tomatoes in Australia are using the same exact genetic material that they're using in the United States and Northern Europe.
Which brings us to your research. What have you been doing to trace down where the flavors come from and how possibly by new techniques to put them back?
Well, we've basically taken a huge step backwards. We've gone back, in some cases, well over 100 years to old varieties that really do taste good. And that's been the whole basis of our research, is to go back and say, well, what is a good flavored tomato? And so we've spent a lot of time screening a lot of varieties to try and get at that question of what is the chemistry of a good tasting tomato and what went wrong with it along the way.
So what have you got so far? The ingredients?
Oh, yeah. We know the ingredients. We can tell you right now what, I use the word recipe for a great tasting tomato, is. We know which chemicals drive consumer preferences, and that allows us to focus on those chemicals in terms of getting them back again.
And what do you need to do now to get them into supermarket tomatoes? You know, what breeding techniques, and how long will it take?
Yeah. Well, it's very clear, due to costs, if nothing else, that a GMO approach is not acceptable.
So you can't do GM?
We won't do GM. Honestly, if I could do GM and it was not prohibitively expensive for the regulatory approval, I could probably give you a great taste. Well, I could have already given you a great tasting tomato. but we are restricted by cost. And
but why should regulation be costly?
The best estimate in the United States, if you want to get approval of a GMO product, one GMO product is about $15 million. University professor cannot do that.
I mean, who gets the $15 million?
The government.
But why?
Well, because there have to be some regulations, but I think that the anti-GMO movement really has driven it probably a little further than we would like. So you really have to go to great lengths to prove that that thing is completely safe. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but what it means is that you really have to have a blockbuster product in order to justify that kind of cost. It has to be something that is going to be grown on many, many acres and brings really high value, or it just doesn't pay. And that's why you see so few GMO crops out there now.
So you're going to have to go the other route and do traditional breeding. How long will that take?
Well, because, again, flavor is so complicated, it's got a bunch of genes that we're all going to have to fix. We can probably make a real significant improvement on the flavor with four or five genes. But that means that I have to go back to the old varieties. I have to identify markers that track those genes when I then do the traditional genetic approach. And I've got to get them all into that background of that commercial variety that the grower will actually be willing to put in the field. So I would say that that's going to take us, optimistically, 3 to 4 years.
And that's still cheaper than paying $15 million to the government for GMOs.
Yeah, and it avoids the baggage of all of the anti-GMO people picketing our lab.
I just wonder whether there's anything in the ingredients that could possibly be harmful, you know, in the flavors that could be against your health.
No, I mean, I think in principle here, we're just going back to what existed prior to the intensive breeding. I mean, we're really going back only less than 100 years and saying, all I want to do is reconstruct the tomato that existed 100 years ago, but I want to do it in a package that has disease resistance and can be grown fairly easily. I mean, anybody who's ever grown these heirlooms will tell you they are pain to grow. I mean, they're just not very good, healthy plants. They're susceptible to diseases. So we have to be able to improve the heirloom performance but maintain the flavor.
And I suppose what you're doing with the tomato is pretty much the same for a number of vegetables and fruit?
Yeah, absolutely. The things, the pathways that we work on, the biochemical pathways for the synthesis of these compounds are present in lots of different plants. So if I look at all sorts of different fruits, we see commonalities. We see the same volatile compounds showing up in different ratios, different concentrations, but many of the same building blocks are present in all of the different fruits and vegetables.
Many thanks, and presumably you agree that Italians are best?
No.
The cheerfully professorial Harry Klee, he's at the University of Florida.